Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Thank you for joining me for this show. I'm actually scrambling a little bit trying to figure out what I want to talk about today. I do want to mention before we get rolling here that, let's see, the weekend after next, so a week from this coming Friday, is our final reality of the season. Okay, it's in Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia, April 19th and 20th. Okay, still room for more people. So if you go to realityapologetics.com, you can sign up there. We are thrilled with the way this event has gone so far. We've had sold out venues in virtually every single city we've gone to. And this particular event is especially important. I guess I could say that about all of the topics that we've covered at Reality, but I think this particular event is significant because of what people are struggling with. All right, and I think many Christians are struggling, and non-Christians as well, when the theme of the world or the U.S. that we constantly get hit with, the ethic of the age, is you do you. All of the responsibility for building one's own identity, whatever that is, for however long it lasts, is on the individual. And I think Alan Schliemann put it this way: we were never meant to carry that responsibility. And that's overwhelming for a lot of people. It becomes the existential problem. And this is, in other words, the personal challenge that people face in their lives now when push comes to shove. When they find themselves in circumstances where they're thinking about deepest reality, the deepest significance, the most important things, the question of who am I and what am I and why am I here and what is expected of me and how should I live and how should I act, those are among the most important questions, maybe the most important, of any individual's life. And what the culture is telling young people, and this includes Christians, is a lie. You can make it up yourself. Now, that's consistent, of course, with an atheistic, materialistic, naturalistic worldview. But, you know, the young people aren't atheists. Young people are spiritual but not religious. That's what we find more and more, because they have a hunger for spiritual things. I was just talking last weekend with somebody who works on campus all the time, moving around, especially up in the New England area. And he said the students that we encounter, and we regularly ask them, do they believe in God or not, or some kind of God? It's very rare for them to run into an atheist. All of them, the great majority, are aware of a deep personal significance to life, the existential element, and life has meaning and there is a spiritual dimension, but they don't know what it is. And therefore, we have something to say to them. But it's not just the secular culture, it's also Christianity. Young people. And this is why suicide is such a big issue. You know, John Noyes, he does the suicide breakout, two of them, every reality. Just like I do tactics every reality, this is a topic that never grows old, and it's always something that we need to impart to the students so they can traffic effectively in conversations with people. Unfortunately, that's true about suicide. That is, it's also a topic that hasn't gone out of style. In fact, it's getting worse because of this distortion that is being fed by the culture about the nature of identity, you do you. And so, incidentally, John Noyes has finished his STRU on suicide, whatever Christian needs to know. It's now available at str.org. And you can take the course. You're a parent, you're a grandparent, you're a student, you're friends of students, you're anybody, because this is such a big deal. But it's a big deal, especially because of this problem in culture. So we have dedicated Reality to that topic this year. We've had 5 events so far, and this is our final one for the season. We're already working on next year's, and the theme then is, it is written. In other words, our theme is going to be a focus on the Word of God and the importance of it, the significance of it, and dealing with challenges regarding the Word of God. So that's coming next time around. But this is your last shot. Georgia, April 19th and 20th. Go to realityapologetics.com and sign up. And we look forward to seeing you there. By the way, on April 13th, Tim Barnett will be at the Christ in Culture Conference right in Ontario, Canada, Saturday, April 13th. That's his home stomping grounds, so we don't have to get him a hotel, probably. He's just going home. But he's going to be involved in that conference, and not sure how much is going on in Canada. Tim does most of his work here in the States, but that's something in the Ontario, Canada region. And John Noyce will be speaking at Crossroads Church in Turlock, California, Sunday, April 14. All right. John Noyce, Crossroads Church, Turlock, California. Now, if you want details on where our speakers will be next, and actually not this coming weekend, the following weekend, of course, we'll be in Augusta the following weekend after that. It's not on my list, but I'm going to be in Montana or Wyoming, whichever the one is further south, because I fly into one. What, Billings, is that Montana? And then I fly into one, and then I drive south to the other. But those details are at str.org/events, str.org/events. You find out where any of our speakers are at. One last thing before we move on to something else, and that has to do with our outposts. I am so thrilled about the strategy that I actually thought of so long ago that I was inspired by something that was called Mac User Groups. Now, you got to be kind of ancient to remember that. But that's like mid-80s or late 80s when Macintoshes first came out, and I started buying them right away, those boxy things. And part of what Apple was doing was trying to generate interest and community interest of people of like mind by encouraging people to get together in Apple or Mac user groups. And I thought we should do that with Stand to Reason Apologetics, and we actually never really had the resources to do it until recently, 30 years into the enterprise. And that's when Robbie Lashua came on board and is overseeing the outpost strategy, in which we have a director who then puts together a group, usually in a local church, something like that. And they meet at different times, weekly or biweekly or monthly, whatever you guys want to do, using STR materials and STRU, but you can use other materials too, of course, to build up that local community in the ability to make the case for the truth of Christianity. And also, and this is something that's very important to us, becoming a resource to others in that community. Most pastors can't do this kind of thing. They got other things on their plate. They're not trained in this area. You have an outpost with people who are trained, then others in the church can go there to any of those individuals for help and encouragement with challenges they're facing. By the way, this has been a tremendously successful enterprise so far. We're about a year and a half into our strategy, and under Robbie's leadership, we have outposts. We have 111 outposts in Canada, England, Australia, Ireland, Zambia, Portugal, and 33 different U.S. states. So if you're interested in becoming a director of a new outpost or joining an existing outpost, I want you to visit str.org/outposts, and you can learn more there. They are local communities of Christians seeking answers to the hard questions about classical Christianity, and each outpost is led by a qualified director who provides SDR content on Christian apologetics and leads discussions on defending the faith. Okay, very flexible, and just more and more people want to be directors. Now, you got to jump through some hoops, and we've got to vet our directors, but it's not an impossible job. We got 111 of them in a year and a half. And moving rapidly as we're expanding. I didn't realize we had this many countries. I just thought we had like three. They even included Canada as a country, Tim Barnett. So you reach that status there. And I knew about England. I didn't know about Australia or Zambia or Ireland or Portugal. So it's good to see this expansion. So glad for that. Now, I got a bunch of stuff I want to talk to you about here leading out this session. And the first one is a remarkable experience I had yesterday in being able to view the total eclipse of the sun. Now, I'm in L.A., and that wasn't on the plane of the ecliptic for that total eclipse. But it turned out this last weekend I was working in St. Louis, and we were right on the edge. And I got finished my work on Sunday. My flight out on Monday was 7 o'clock. And so I had all day to kind of get in position for the mid-afternoon eclipse. And we actually started heading south to Cape Girardeau because that was where my buddy Shane's family or family members were at, and they were all going to aggregate there. But it seemed like everybody in St. Louis had the same idea. And that highway was so clogged up, we had to get off. And then we figured, wait a minute, this plane of the ecliptic runs kind of southwest to northeast, and it crosses over south of St. Louis, but also east of St. Louis. So let's not go south where everybody else is going. Let's just go east. And so we did that and found some highways heading east into Illinois, across the river, and into Illinois, my home state. And we just kept going, knowing when the total eclipse would happen on the clock, and we just kept going as far east as possible to find any kind of berg that was indicated on Google would have a 100% eclipse moment. Now, I didn't realize this, okay, but I figured, you know, what you could see is you'd see the moon going over the sun halfway or a quarter if you're not right in the path, and you just see a piece of it, okay? And then you can see a partial eclipse. Well, you can do that actually with wearing the appropriate glasses. But one thing I noticed is even though we were in the zone for a total eclipse, using the glasses, I noticed that the sun was almost 95% occluded. In other words, the moon is almost covering it and the sun didn't look any different. There was so much juice coming out of the sun, it was still blaring. Now, what we did is we're heading further east, and so this is where, you know, I thought if we don't go right into the path of the shadow of the moon on the earth, moving northeast, we could see it on the edge and kind of catch a partial eclipse. But there's no way it's going to make a real difference unless you're looking through those glasses, because nothing significant is going to change around you with a partial eclipse. There's too much juice coming from the sun. It's still plenty warm. It's still pretty bright. And there was a cloudless sky on Monday for us there in that area. So we had to make sure we found a place that was a 100% total eclipse area. Now, if you think about that shadow that goes across, you know, the shadow of the moon, that's what it amounts to. That's what an eclipse is. It's the shadow of the moon. Okay, well, that's round. That's a round shadow, and it covers a lot of ground. But if you are in the very middle of that round shadow, that total eclipse lasts for a long time. But if you're just on the edge of that shadow, then you're just going to get a little 2 or 3 minutes of total eclipse before you get sunlight again. And it turns out we were just trying to get over the edge to get somewhere where we could get 100% occlusion and a total solar eclipse. And we found a little town called St. Peter, population 400. I took a picture of the sign. And right at the end of town, there's a little, gin mill, a couple of trucks pulled up. And that's where we stopped, started jawing with some of the people there. They're standing in the parking lot. They had the glasses. And so we put them on, and we can see we're getting closer and closer and closer. But I didn't really notice anything around me until we hit total eclipse. And just before we hit total eclipse, you could feel the temperature drop dramatically, at least a 10-degree drop. And things started getting dusky. It's like, you know, when dusk approaches and it's just getting soft all around you until the moon's disk moved directly over the sun, and then everything just went out. It's like the lights went out. Wow. And then, this is what I was told by Amy, so I believed her, and I think I survived okay. Then you don't need the glasses. You can just look at the total eclipse of the sun, and it is otherworldly. It was very cool. Now, I know there's going to be another one in, what, 22 years? I don't think I'm going to last till I'm 96, maybe. But I figured I better get a shot at this one while I could, and I was glad that I had the opportunity. Actually, a bunch of our team, including Amy, flew to Dallas. There was some cloud cover there, so some of them, like Alan Schliemann and I think Robbie Lash, they decided to drive to Arkansas. Go figure. So they wouldn't have the cloud cover, but it turned out pretty good in Dallas, apparently, and I got a picture of a really good picture of the eclipse. Now, I took pictures with my iPhone, but, you know, just that little corona, that glowing corona around the edges, once the whole sun is blocked, you still see the fire around the edges. That was enough to overpower my iPhone and overexpose the shots I was taking. So I got these shots of a glowing dot with a little circle in the middle. Just a little bit of the moon would show up there, but it wasn't the dramatic total eclipse look that you've seen probably in pictures somewhere. And somebody with Amy apparently take this picture right after the total eclipse began to reverse, or maybe just before, like 99.5%, which means there's a little bitty bit of the sun proper that is still glowing, which makes the whole thing look like a diamond ring. Because you got this total eclipse, this circular thing, and then you have this little glowing spot. And it was great. So I have my lousy pictures, and I have Amy's great picture that she got from someone. I just wanted to put it on my Facebook so everybody could see it, but I realized it's not mine, somebody else's. So in any event, it was great. And then since we were right on the edge, in about 3 or 4 minutes, it was over with. The sun came out again, and temperature started going up, and time for us to head to the airport so I could fly back. It's a great experience, though. And I kept hearing in my head Carly Simon's song, the You're So Vain song. You probably think this song is about you. There's a line in there about this vain person traveling somewhere to see the total eclipse of the sun. Well, that's what I did. I was there, and some of the others were too. But it's a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm glad that Shane Rosenthal, a host of Humble Skeptic, late of the White Horse Inn broadcast for many years with them, and now doing his own thing. It was great. He was a great host for me, and we had this great experience. So anyway, that's the first thing. Now, the second thing that I wanted to talk to you about, maybe we should take a break, and then I'll get into my second deal. What do you think? I'll get a breather. Let's do this. We're 20 minutes into the first segment. And then I had a couple of experiences while I was on the road, and they were very interesting. Just going to pass them on. There are times when I kind of wish that all of you were flies on the wall of conversations that I've had. And not because I was so profound. That's not the reason. It's because they were interesting engagements. And obviously, given the nature of these engagements, divine appointments. Now, it's not my conviction that every encounter is a divine appointment. I think some things are just truly serendipitous. They're accidents, if you will. That is, that there is no divine intention with this meeting, and we're like ships passing in the night. And there are other times where you realize this didn't happen by accident. Okay, and I'll tell you about two of those when we return here on Stand to Reason.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking, and we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic, and subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Have you seen our brand new website? Stop by str.org and enjoy a fresh, clean layout with all the same great content. The new Stand to Reason website was designed with you in mind. It has an easier than ever navigation and a crisp, simple layout so you can find all the sound analysis and careful commentary that you've come to expect from us. Browse new features that make finding your favorite resources easier than ever. As always, it's our goal to equip you, our fellow Christians, with a confidence, clear thinking, and courage you need for every encounter you have as a Christian ambassador. Our new website is just one way we're fulfilling that goal, allowing you to access the resources you need in a new and improved way. So visit str.org and keep coming back to discover new podcasts, articles, and videos each and every day.
All right, one other thing I wanted to say about a total eclipse. And I think this never occurred to me until I talked with J. Wesley Richards about his book with Guillermo Gonzalez, Privileged Planet. And that's probably 10, 12, 15 years ago. Great book about intelligent design. And he, Jay, I think at the time was with... Discovery Institute, and we've done lots of things over the years together. But one of the things I learned from that book, and it never occurred to me, is the unique nature of a total eclipse of the sun. So, if any of you are familiar, obviously, with the concept, or if you viewed it yesterday, or even on TV, seen pictures of it. You realize that the disk of the moon, when it accomplishes a total eclipse, it's just in the right path. Well, it's not in any path. It's just doing what it does. If you are at the right place on the Earth, when the shadow of the moon blocking the sun crosses over with a total eclipse, the moon is perfectly coterminous visually with the sun. That is, the diameter of the moon is perfectly coterminous with the diameter of the sun. So it completely blocks the entire sun out visually to us, and all you can see is this flaming corona around the edge, which is what makes a total eclipse so magnificent. Now, by the way, if you're looking with those little glasses and you're not in the path of the total eclipse, you can see the partial eclipse. And what you're going to see is a disk, the sun glowing, and another disk floating by, blocking it, a portion of it, and then floating past. So, but you're looking with the glasses, and you're not, okay, all you see is like these disks crossing each other. There's nothing really dramatic about it. And you can't see it without the special glasses because first of all, you're going to burn your eyeballs out if you look too hard. And secondly, you're not going to see it because the sun's glow is so powerful, you won't even see the moon crossing over, blocking the sun. Even a little portion of the sun's glow is going to overpower your vision. And here, I'll tell you what I was thinking as we're driving to this location where there'd be a total eclipse. I see the sun up there, but I'm looking around for the moon. And what I'm expecting to see is that the moon is going to be traveling across the sky and intercepting the sun. Well, I never saw that. I couldn't find the moon. It turned out the reason that I couldn't find it is the moon was too close to the sun for the whole time I was looking. And that's why it was obliterated by the glare of the sun, unless you had those glasses and you look and you could see them both. But what you do see with a total eclipse is that complete occlusion of the sun because of that perfect fit. And think of what's going to be required for a perfect fit. If the sun was further away from the earth or closer to the earth, you're not ever going to get a perfect fit. If the moon was the sun was a different size, or if the moon was a different size or further away from the earth or closer to the earth, you're not going to get a perfect fit. It's only the sun that we have in our solar system at the distance that it is. What, 96? I used to know this number. I want to say it's 186,000 miles a second, but that's the speed of light. So 96 million miles, I don't know what it is. And I don't even know how far the moon is. But because of the size of the moon and the size of the sun and the distance relative between the moon and the sun and the moon and the earth, you have this very unique coincidence where you can get a perfect solar eclipse. Now, I'll tell you that why this is significant, and this goes back to Jay Richards' Privileged Planet with Guillermo Gonzalez. It's significant because when there is a perfect total eclipse, it allows scientists to see things beyond the edge of the sun that it never saw before, and even things in the sun. And all of these things have to do with a discovery of other fine-tuned aspects of the universe, which is one of the reasons I think that the book is titled The Privileged Planet. We are privileged to have a moon and sun in this particular juxtaposition such that with total eclipses, you're going to be able to see things you couldn't see. But it's also privileged because of what you see. You realize that there are all these design parameters that are just so that make this planet perfectly suited for the existence of complex life forms that have the ability of developing technology eventually that can then look at a total eclipse with that technology and discover how special they are. That's pretty cool, isn't it? I like that. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about my encounters. Now, I had heard that there's going to be a lot of difficulty at the airports, and I go to LAX, because there's a lot of people that are going to be flying to different locations to be able to watch the total eclipse of the sun. And so I thought, I usually get to the airport about an hour and a half before my flight leaves. The way I work it is, I leave my house 3 hours before the plane is supposed to leave the airport. It's a 45-minute drive, no traffic. I give myself twice amount of time. And then if I get there an hour and a half early, it's twice as much time as I need to get to my gate. So I double-double. I got lots of margin because I don't want to miss a flight, which I don't think I ever have. But I didn't want to run into problems because of all of the eclipse travel, and I heard there was a lot. So I went like 3 hours early, earlier than normal. And turned out there wasn't any traffic, and there's on the roads by the airport or in the airport. So I got in real quickly. I had like 3 hours to kill. So I went to a little restaurant and sat down there to get a bite to eat. And there was a couple that was the next table over, and they were a young couple. Turns out they were newlyweds and just coming back from Fiji on their honeymoon and all aglow, very sweet people. But he was wearing a bit like a baseball cap that had St. Croix Rods logo on it. Now, St. Croix Rods are really good fishing rods, top-end, very expensive rods. Now, I don't want to spend money for those rods. It's too much money. So I buy the blanks at a discount, and then I make my own rods from it, put the grips on and the eyes and whatever. So, and I have some of those. But I asked him about that, and he said, it turns out in the St. Croix manufacturing plant is 40 minutes from my cabin in Wisconsin. And anyway, I asked him about the hat in our conversation. It turns out they have a property probably 25 minutes, not even that long, 20 minutes from where my cabin is at in northern Wisconsin. So now we're chatting about that. So he's a fisherman, and they have a place, and then, and it turns out that they go to a Catholic church there in the town of Lac du Flambeau. Now, that's a church I went to as a kid, but I'm not Roman Catholic, so I don't go there anymore, and I mentioned I go to a Protestant church in Woodruff. But now, and then there were some more things about the conversation. They go to church on a regular basis, and then they told me about a conference they went to where there were 20,000 Roman Catholics. So now I'm getting the picture. These very sweet people were very committed Roman Catholics. I'm no longer Roman Catholic, and the reason I'm no longer Roman Catholic is I don't think Rome gets certain things right, and especially the grace of God and the cross. And I'm not going to go into details about why that's the case. We've talked about it here before. But one of the things that was a powerful influence on me when I heard the gospel was I heard the gospel. I heard the grace of God. Because as a Roman Catholic, I never knew whether or not I would go to heaven. That's just you hope. Okay? You don't know. And now this does raise a question, and I think this is fair to ask Roman Catholics. Given that the gospel is good news, do you know whether or not you're going to heaven? Now, Catholics are going to say no, and because they don't know if they're good enough, and they'll find out when they die. But listen to what that means they're facing. This is like saying there are two doors. When you die, you're going to go through one of two doors. One leads to everlasting perdition and punishment, and one to everlasting joy. But you don't know which one you're going to walk through. How is that good news? If the gospel is good news, how is the message that gives you with that opportunity without certainty, how can that possibly be good news? Now, I think it's a fair question. And one that if I had the right kind of conversation, I would ask Roman Catholics. Now, I believe there are a lot of Roman Catholics that understand the grace of God, and there are a lot of Protestants that don't. But one of the reasons I wrote The Story of Reality is to be able to communicate the plan of salvation in a narrative form from the beginning to the very end, not just Jesus. So when I meet anybody of any Christian denominational tradition that I have a sense that may not understand the grace of God, I don't go after them or after their tradition, okay? I want to try to come in the side and just communicate the grace of God in a way that's consistent with the Scripture, in a way that is actually good news. And so in conversation, I might offer to give this book away. I always carry A Story of Reality with me. And then the miniature version, which is just the portion of The Story of Reality that has to do with Jesus and the cross and the resurrection. And I call that The Story of Why God Died and Came to Life Again. It's got a separate title, but it's just a chunk of the larger book. So we were having a wonderful conversation. They're very, very sweet people. Okay, and I'm kicking myself because I didn't get their phone number because they're going to be there over the 4th of July when I'm going to be there, and I would love to have contacted them and, you know, invited them out in the boat with me to go fishing or something like that. But maybe they'll contact me, I don't know, through the website because they have that information. But I offered them the smaller booklet if they wanted it, The Story of Why God Died and Came to Life Again, which is just the Jesus section of the larger book, The Story of Reality, okay? But as we were talking, they were happy to have it, but as we were talking, it was clear to me that they had a much deeper interest in spiritual things and committed as he was heading for a program in studying philosophy, an MA Phil program. So I thought, oh, great. Well, maybe you'd want the larger treatment rather than the smaller. And they jumped on it readily. So that was a great opportunity. It was very sweet talking to them. Never got in a fuss or an argument. Didn't need to. I just wanted to help them understand the grace of God better than maybe they already did. And I have questions about that with those who are involved in Catholicism because of my own experience. But nevertheless, that's all I wanted. And I'm trusting and I prayed for them that God, they would read that and that this would draw them closer to Christ. And it might turn out that that I see them again in the summer in the Northwoods. And we might stretch a line together, okay, with our LaCroix rods, St. Croix rods, rather. But the point there, I think, is I was just, in a sense, using the tactical game plan, asking questions, drawing people out, showing an interest in sweet people and enjoying my interaction with them, always with the mind of how can I leave something behind that will have spiritual value for them. Didn't have to push. Didn't have to try to take exception with someone's theology or denomination. Just as Paul said, making the most of the opportunity. Conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, he said, making the most of the opportunity. And let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so you know how to respond to each person. So he says, be smart. Then he says, be nice. Then he says, be tactical. And it was so sweet to be able to have that conversation with them. Okay, so they had to go off to their flight back to Wisconsin. I had to get on a plane for St. Louis. Now, I've been reading a book that my daughter had purchased for me. It was a Christmas present. She knows I like Lewis. Tolkien, she does too, especially Tolkien. She loves the fantasy stuff. This is my eldest, Annabeth. And she got a book for me, very thick. It's 500 pages of narrative substance, not counting the index, which is another 100 pages. Big book. It's called The Fellowship. And The Fellowship is a book about the literary lives of the Inklings. And there are four that are focused in on there, of course, Lewis and Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. And is it Hugo Dyson? No. Hugo Dyson's not one of the main ones, but he's in there. It's, goodness, I should write this down before I start. Charles Williams, and I'll think of the other name in a minute. Because they include some of the others too, but it's really a look at their literary contributions, and it's a great narrative. But it turns out that, holy cow, what is that guy's name? Amy, do you know? She's out there somewhere listening. Yeah, we talked about this last week. Okay, so I'm back at it again. Barfield, thank you. Owen Barfield. I'm going to write it down now. Owen Barfield. And Barfield especially, but also Williams, these guys were involved in some weird things. Anthroposophy. This is a kind of an esoteric Christianity. That means they're taking Christianity and mixing it with other kind of strange things, like reincarnation and the Christ spirit that descends upon you and all kinds of odd things. Gnostic, actually, more akin to Gnosticism than it is to Christianity. And there are some things that don't mix, and esoteric doesn't mix with Christian. Not the way they're characterizing it. So this was really weird because here's two guys in the Inklings that are into weird stuff, Christianity plus weird things. On my assessment, as I'm reading through it, I'm about 400 pages in. I really doubt that these guys are Christians. But nevertheless, they're part of the Inklings. So I'm just getting inside scoop on a lot of this stuff. And they are devotees of a writer, especially Barfield, whose name is Rudolf Steiner. And Rudolf Steiner is the apostle of esoteric Christianity. And so I'm introduced then to Rudolf Steiner, and I'm reading about it. I'm understanding about Gosh, I have a hard time saying that. Anthroposophy. Why would anybody make a name for a religion that was so hard to pronounce? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's not good for PR. In any event, I sit down. I have in my hand a copy, what's left of my two books. I'd given The Story of Reality away, but now I still have The Story of Why God Died, and I'm actually reading it. I'm reading my own book. Why? I like it. It edifies me, and I think it's well written. So I'm just saying. And the woman sits down next to me. Her name's Christine, and it's a very sweet woman. I'd say like mid-50s. And she sees the why God died, the God died part. She asks, oh, is that postmodern? Is that postmodernism? And I looked at her. I said, no, it's not postmodernism. It's actually Christian. Not postmodern, but I'm curious. How would you know what postmodernism even is? Are you an academic? She said, yes, I am. And she's a professor at a junior college here in Southern California and has credentials in the area of communication. And then she says, no, I said, no, this is a Christian book. I said, and I'm a Christian. And she said, so am I. I'm an esoteric Christian. And sitting in her lap, as God is my witness, the book that she's getting ready to read with her husband on her right, she was in the middle, I was by the window, was a book titled Esoteric Christianity by Rudolf Steiner. Can you believe that? I had never even heard of Steiner before I started reading this book on the Inklings titled The Fellowship, and I had that book in my bag. I had been reading all about Steiner through the lives of Owen Barfield and Charles Williams, and also listening to the pushback that Tolkien and Lewis were given to their buddies as part of the Inklings, given their esoteric Christianity. They didn't like that. So, and of course, the Inklings was a pugilistic society. They beat each other up in a friendly fashion on their ideas and on their writings. But isn't that funny, though? I mean, who'd have thunk? You've got this, out of nowhere, I'm reading this book, and I find out, and then here's somebody sitting down, and there's the book right in her lap, Rudolf Steiner. Now, it gave us an opportunity to have a long conversation, but I'll tell you how I conducted myself. When she said, I'm an esoteric Christian, what do you think the first thing I said was? I said, what's an esoteric Christian? Because that's the first step of our game plan, gathering information. Now, I know what an esoteric Christian is. I don't know what she thought an esoteric Christian was. And in any event, I wanted her to start talking about her own convictions. And the more she talked about her own convictions, the more questions I had about things she said that were unclear or ambiguous, or I thought of a concern in light of their connection with Christianity. And one of those was reincarnation. She believed in reincarnation. It's in the Bible. She said, I can show you where it's at. Now, I didn't ask for her to do that. I know there's no reincarnation in the Bible properly read, and this is not a tricky issue. But I didn't want to get in a combative relationship with her. I wanted to just keep asking her clarification questions and verification questions, step one and step two, as in just listening as she talked, trusting that God would use that or maybe some side comment I'd make to put a stone in her shoe and to get her thinking. Okay, now as it turned out, I didn't have any sense I made any difference. But we talked for, I'd say, an hour of a 3.5-hour flight before I went back to my book and began reading The Fellowship about Owen Barfield and Charles Williams and J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, and more about Rudolf Steiner in that book. So I don't know what is going to become of that, but that was another occasion where I kind of wished you guys could have been a fly on the wall, as it were, And just because I think it might have been instructive as the way I moved through that conversation, just like the earlier one. Now notice what I'm doing. I'm really trying to avoid having a head-to-head clash on some of these things. I'm trying to be gentle, trying to be gracious, trying to ask the kinds of questions that will give me more information about the person and their point of view. I'm gathering intel, and then also might suggest other questions I would ask to get them thinking about the legitimacy of their point of view. And if nothing else, and this was especially true in the with Christine as opposed to with the Roman Catholic couple, if nothing else, I'm getting an education about an unusual view of Christianity. We didn't go into theology at all with the newlywed couple, but in this case, we were. But I'm asking the questions, and now I'm getting an education. And sometimes you come away from these circumstances, and maybe you didn't make any dent at all for the truth, but you come back better apprised of the other person's view. So you can be maybe better equipped for the next time around. And that's kind of, that's my takeaway from that second conversation. Who knows what God's going to do? That's his business. Can we take another quick break before, or, let me just see something here. Yeah, okay, one more quick break, and then I'll do a question here from our open mic calls. Hold on, be back in a minute.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Just a note, we've got another hour of recording to go ahead of us, and some of you might be listening on live streaming. We've got an open board right now. My number is 855-243-9975. That's 855-243-9975. We've got about 10 minutes to go here in this segment, so let's take an open mic call from Faye Ann, and she has a question about a slippery slope fallacy.
Hi, Greg. This is Faye Ann from Indianapolis. Thank you for considering my question. My question is, I heard a couple apologetics say that, speaking about people who say that they are born gay and we just need to accept that, and then the apologetics had went on to say, well, we need to follow the logic to find the problem, take the logic to the extreme, until they said if someone were to say, well, I'm a murderer, you need to accept who I am, then that doesn't make any sense, which I agree. But also, wouldn't that be considered the slippery slope fallacy? Thank you.
Okay, good question. And I'm glad we're able to talk about the slippery slope fallacy. Now, what you had heard, Faye Ann, was somebody offering what I call, and I got this from Francis Schaeffer, taking the roof off. That is, you take their point of view, and if you take it seriously, you see where it logically leads. And if it leads to something disastrous and you're following it faithfully, then there must be something wrong with the view. It's kind of like you give it a test drive, and if you drive off the cliff, then there's a problem with where you started. Okay. This is also called a reductio. A reductio ad absurdum. That is, you reduce it to its absurd consequence, taking the view seriously. Now, that's an important part of this. There is a sense in which you are advocating this slippery slope. If you start here, this is where you slip down to. But not every slippery slope appeal is a fallacy. And some people want to just dismiss it. Oh, that's the slippery slope fallacy. There are actually two different types of slippery slope. One is called a causal slippery slope, all right? And that's when the thing that you're considering doing may all by itself in isolation not be immoral. But it may lead to something immoral, and then that casts aspersions on the original act itself. Paul gives an example of this when he talks about eating meat sacrificed to idols. Is that wrong? No, it's not, he says. However, some people think it's wrong, and in virtue of this conviction, if they see you exercising appropriate liberty, that might cause them to do the thing they think is wrong. Note the causal relationship there. And since that's causing a brother to stumble, that is, fall into sin, as they see you exercising your liberty, then that calls into question the liberty itself, which, like I said, taken on its own, would not be problematic, okay? The first thing that is not immoral causes the second thing that is immoral, raising questions now about the morality of the first thing. It's immoral for you to cause another person to do something immoral, even though the action that's causing that is not itself immoral. Now, that's called a causal slippery slope. And it's a fallacy if there's no causal relationship. If you're saying, well, it leads to this good thing leads to this bad thing, but it doesn't lead to that bad thing. So therefore, it's a fallacious appeal. So that's one type of slippery slope. What you have offered here, Fayanne, is called a logical slippery slope. A logical slippery slope. In other words, you look at a certain claim, and the claim it has to do, in this case, with morality. It says basically that being gay is justified because I was born that way. Let's just take it that way. Born that way, so it's okay. Now, notice that's an attempt to justify morally the behavior of homosexuality, but it only works if there's a certain line of thinking that justifies it. The line of thinking is this: if I'm born that way, then that makes it morally okay. Now, that line of thinking, if it works for homosexuality, can be applied to others. That logical way of looking at it, that logic, if legitimate, then can be applied to other things. What about, and I've made this point myself, what if I was born just I had this terrible anger that was constantly expressed towards gay people? Maybe I was a gay basher, and let's just stipulate I was born that way. That's the criteria that's offered logically to justify the morality of homosexuality. Well, if I was born mad and bad, then that would also, by the same line of reasoning, justify my mad badness. Wouldn't it? Why not? It's the same justification. That is called a logical slippery slope. And this is what you're offered here, Fayanne, a logical slippery slope. And by the way, it's not a fallacy. Unless you have mischaracterized the logical relationship that justifies the first thing or misapplied it in the second case. But in this case, I don't think you have. Now, saying, what if I was born a murderer? I don't know if there is such a thing. But some people seem to be born really crabby and born really nasty. You have the bad seed. And so, but even in principle, if we could isolate certain, I should say, if we could identify certain behaviors as being genetic, born that way, then that would justify anything that we were born with. I mean, look, one could say I was born heterosexual. And so I have these, as a guy, natural, born that way, heterosexual attractions to other women. So there could be nothing morally questionable about my acting out those things, even with other people's wives, because I was born that way with that urge. Now, notice in this situation, we're just applying the same set of rules that are meant to justify one type of sexual behavior to justify another type of sexual behavior. If it works to justify the first, then in virtue of a logical slippery slope, it also justifies the second. And this is also what I call taking the roof off from Francis Schaeffer, but it's another reductio ad absurdum. It's only a fallacy if we have misconstrued the logic of the slippery slope, or we've misapplied it to the second issue. In this case, we haven't. The logic is, if I'm born that way, then it's morally okay. Homosexuals are born that way, and this is a matter of dispute, by the way. They're not, by any scientific evidence that we have. But nevertheless, that's the way the argument goes. Then it's morally okay. Well, then anything that we are born with based on that reasoning and in virtue of a logical slippery slope, anything that nefarious that we at least arguably are born with should be allowed morally, because after all, we're just doing what comes naturally. And that's a logical slippery slope properly applied. So there you go, Fayann. Hope that's helpful. Two types of slippery slopes. There can be fallacies, but just because you claim a slippery slope doesn't mean it's a fallacy, and that's where a lot of people want to dismiss it. I just kind of gave you the criterion for both of them, and I hope it's fruitful for you. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.